This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest right now? Are you feeling lonely, unappreciated, or misunderstood? When you keep these feelings bottled up, they can affect you negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's a great way to increase your self-awareness, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/beherenow.
Welcome to the Be Here Now Network guest podcast. This series features talks from a myriad of modern spiritual teachers expanding on how we can all live a life in balance. If you're interested in supporting this podcast, please go to BeHereNowNetwork.com/guest.
My name is Locke Kelly, and I'll be joined by Father Thomas Keating to discuss spiritual practice and share some of our insights. I am a meditation teacher, psychotherapist, and author of a recent book called Shift into Freedom on a particular method of spiritual practice that I've found helpful. And Father Thomas Keating is a Trappist monk and a priest for over 70 years who lives in Snowmass, Colorado. He's one of the architects of Centering Prayer and also one of the co-founders of Contemplative Outreach. So we've both been involved in interspiritual dialogue, particularly with people who do spiritual practice, both in their lives and as their main way of living. And I think we've had some great dialogues along the way. I'm glad to have you all here with us so that we can share a little bit of what we have been talking about for many years together. So I'll just say that one of the premises in our mystical or non-dual approach is that the spirit or awake awareness or our true nature called Buddha nature, Christ consciousness, ever-present life itself is already here within us and as us. So grace is already available, and we can use spiritual practice as a way of shifting into this dimension of consciousness, which is really in the human being lineage. So, Father Thomas, would you like to say something to begin?
Well, this is a rather big subject. We could begin almost anywhere on earth or even be other places if you like. But to make it practical, perhaps to speak, there's one point I'd like to make that I think is crucial for our time, and that is that the science is giving us some discoveries that have provided, I think, all the religions with a whole new set of facts that are metaphors of the spiritual life and even of daily practice. Yes. Maybe I'll just begin with one. When I was on the same platform with a wonderful Zen master, Katagiri Rashi, since deceased, in Minneapolis, he gave this teaching that in Zen, at least his school of Zen, we go in and out of our creation every 69 times, I think it was, in every second. That means as we're sitting here, we're dissolving and being recreated. In other words, being reaffirmed in the being that we have by the Creator and by God. Well, now science is saying you can break down every second into thousands or trillions of parts. And this even is supposedly a picture of the Big Bang a trillionth of a second after it went off. Yeah. And so just as we sit here chatting, our impermanence is present, and the only reason it's present is because the source of our being is with us, giving us our being at every moment. And
yes,
of course, this presupposes a recognition that creation is not a one-time act,
right,
but it's ongoing all the time.
That's right.
This little idea, whether you accept that hypothesis or not.
Yes.
And it shows how fast science is building or expanding some of the ideas of the great contemplative teachings like Buddhism.
Yes, yes. And certainly I've been involved with a lot of neuroscientists who have been studying contemplatives in using some things like the fMRI and showing that these kind of contemplative practices make real changes in our brain in relation to increasing a sense of peace and increasing a sense of balance and increasing a sense of compassion. And so certainly some of the main contemplative practices or spiritual practices are meditation, prayer, inquiry, and then, of course, compassionate activity, some kind of service, which is important too. So as we recognize through these dimensions, we can access what you were talking about, which is this constant change. And wouldn't you also say that in some level, there's some dimension of being that doesn't come and go, some eternal, essential now, while everything is appearing and disappearing moment to moment, in a way, there's some essential source or ground of being?
Yes, I think this idea of ongoing creation is the first principle of the whole evolutionary view that science has given us in our time that wasn't available to previous generations of mystics, but which has given us tools that never existed before in history, like the discovery of the unconscious in developmental psychology. And the whole development of the human being from zero consciousness up to, from a religious perspective, the divine consciousness itself, at least that's Christianity's contribution, that the Trinity is the relationship of the absolutely transcendent God that enables creatures like us to have a relationship with God and to be transformed ultimately into his divine nature insofar as that's possible for a human being.
Yes. Yeah, beautiful. So that's very similar to the non-dual traditions as well, is that it's both the eternal or the infinite is appearing as the finite, that it's not just a transcendent escape from human life, but it's a discovery of a larger, subtler, more vast, both higher, deeper, wider dimension of consciousness that is greater, both greater than ourselves and is essentially who we are at our deepest core. And discovering that, it seems, requires that we name the main obscuration to that, which is a kind of separate sense of self, a sense of separation, aloneness, existential feeling of being apart. Would you say that's important to?
Yes, that's the fundamental problem of all difficulties.
Right.
Is
right.
The idea that we're separate from God and from each other. Heal those two things and we would find peace in ourselves and in other people, in our relationship. Right now, the world is in a place of incredible ignorance compared to the truths that the mystical life has been trying to share over the centuries. And it's a tremendous crisis, but a tremendous opportunity to make use of the new means at our disposal, to find new metaphors that help us to understand this practice and practical. For instance, just take an iPhone or an iPad.
Yeah.
You can talk to anybody in the world anytime you like about any subject you like. Well, it's a metaphor of the fact that we have the apparatus within us or on our wrist, in the case of an iPad, I guess, to be in contact with the divine at every moment of our being. And so just to remember that, just to think of, look at your iPhone. It's God is talking to you at every moment and suggesting what to do and healing our wounds and showing us this tremendous love that is trying to make us one with himself or herself, if you prefer. And this is available to every human being.
Yes.
But as you said, we start out with the idea that we're separate. And then when our mother isn't going to provide all our needs, it begins to dawn on us, we better take care of ourselves in some respects. Yes. Then begins this long journey of development that is very hard to prevent really young people from being overly dominated by the culture of the time or their parental influences or the groups to which they belong, because all those things appeal to the desperate need that is a response to the separate self sense, which is the need for security, the That's need right. for affection and love, and the need for some degree of control over our lives and of our environment and so on.
Yes.
So how to cure that is really the subject, I think, of all the great efforts of all the religions and even of no religion, because God comes to us not only through religion, but through everything else that's created. Its only reason for being is because it manifests something of the divine goodness, beauty, and love.
Yes.
But how to become aware, not just through our thoughts,
right,
but through experience, that this union is really happening, that it's growing, it's deepening, and that if we function on the level of consciousness that we have, evolution itself, without any effort on our part, is going to take us further and allow God to become more God in us.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, as you say, spiritual practice in some ways from this perspective that we're talking about is seeing whether we can directly step out of this separate sense of self and tune in to this unity or oneness or subtler dimension of consciousness, which is more of our true identity. So that separate sense of self in some ways isn't just a belief, but it literally is, as you were talking about developmentally, one of the interesting things that I've explored is it seems to start around the age in a youngster around 1.5 to 3 years old when they develop what's called self-awareness, interestingly. And self-awareness is the time where they begin to see themselves as a subject and as an object. And the way that happens is they say, oh, I'm Billy, I better not touch the stove or I'm going to get in trouble. And then kind of a self-talk begins, a kind of the way that that identity is formed is through self-reflection or thinking about thinking. And that little thinking about thinking creates what I call a little mini-me in the head, behind your eyes, looking out. And that little sense of self drives you crazy. That little sense of self is the false self or the self that feels it's separate because it's made of dualistic thought. And when that pattern of thought, that constellation of consciousness relaxes for a moment, what is revealed often through spiritual practice is that we already are feeling unity and oneness and interconnectedness and a sense of well-being, because that little perpetual dissatisfaction, which is what in Buddhism they call suffering, perpetual dissatisfaction, dukkha, and that suffering is really of this little mini-me, this little pattern of self-referencing that gives us a self-sense. And in fact, you know, those at home could even try this simple inquiry at this time, which is, if that little pattern is just trying to solve a problem continuously, it's just trying to solve the problem of identity. It's kind of taken on the body's craving for finding satisfaction and protection, but there's nothing for it to eat, and there's nothing that can threaten it because it's only a thought-made entity. It feels like it's an entity, but it's a thought-made pattern. So if you just ask yourself now, what's here now if there's no problem to solve?
You described very well what I like to call the self-made or the homemade self.
Yes, that's
it. It doesn't exist in reality. It's our idea of who we are.
That's right.
So one of the great questions today, I think, for practice is, well, what is self?
Right.
This is a source of great discussion, as you know, in theological and psychological and spiritual and now neuroscientific circles. There's been many discussions about that. So if we're not our homemade self, who then are we? Yeah, that's a question ordinary people almost certainly have.
Yes.
And it if they would just keep quiet or learn to have a quiet period in their life, it allows some of that false self material to sort of quiet down. And this is why silence has such a primary place in every meditation practice that I know of. It's not an absolute silence, but it's time or space that is most conducive to allowing it to happen, in which one can do nothing except be and grateful for being alive and open to whatever the present moment brings.
Yes, yeah, that's beautiful.
Gap in the moment, someone said, I thought, great insight. Present moment is God with all the circumstances. It's God is no place else except now. And so we better be there. And the more we can stay in that now, the more God can reveal himself to us and share our lives and teach us how to do everything. And
yes.
In my young years, I only think of living with one purpose in mind, how to give God a chance to take over my life with the experience of one more day.
Yes.
Now I think of half a day. Pretty soon I'll be thinking of a couple of hours.
But we might as well start early, no matter what age we are, right? Just start with one moment at a time.
I'm glad you mentioned that point, because there's no adequate education to teach these fundamentals of the self, homemade self, the false self.
That's right.
So in a language that youngsters can understand it, they need to hear this as soon as possible. It would save them so much trouble if they realize that their thoughts are not really themselves, but
that's right.
They have thoughts, they have feelings, they have sensations, but these are not who we really are.
That's right. But yes, I see that among the millennials, the younger people, is they're so fast, such fast thinkers, and they really create a sense of self and achievement and doing and multitasking very quickly in their minds. And they haven't been presented an alternative. They have music and they have friendship. But just like the rest of us, I think one of the keys is to discover the alternative to thought-based knowing, that through silence or through inquiry, the discovery is that there is an intelligence or an awake alertness that is non-conceptual and yet fully awake and aware. It's almost like, if you know, like our parasympathetic nervous system, like our breath is happening by itself. And in some ways, there's a kind of awareness that's essential awareness that's happening by itself, that doesn't need thought to know, that could use thought if it needed to. But that is the place that I find that's most helpful for people to discover, because that's not on the map of psychology or philosophy.
Well, would you say it's on the map of traditional meditation in the sense of contemplative meditation?
I think it is. I think so. I think it's on in different languages. I think in it's kind of seeing through the eye of the heart. So maybe oculus cordis of.
Yes, you have some great material on putting the mind in the heart.
Yes,
and I think you even add that the grace that sustains us and all our various faculties is being poured into us at every moment.
That's right.
We accept it if we let it happen.
Yes, that's right. And there's a connection.
Make it happen. I don't think that's you can make it to happen, but you can consent to it happening.
Yes, consent to it.
He has this dimension. It used to be called the spirit or the spiritual side of humanity. And of course, science was not comfortable with that idea in earlier periods of its development.
That's right.
But now I think science realizes that even a mystical experience that you can't prove by facts is still a part of the necessary data for science if it's going to fully respond to reality.
Yes, and the contemplative traditions in the past were more tied to their metaphysics and their theology in terms of worldview, and now many of the interspiritual dialogue contemplatives or meditators are realizing, oh, we're really talking about the same thing essentially. And so finding a language, which has kind of been my project, is finding a human being lineage language for something like non-conceptual awareness. So, you know, in Hinduism, it's called Turiya. In Tibetan Buddhism, it's called Rigpa. You know, there's these words for this, and they're often thought to be advanced states that first you have to go through tremendous amount of practices. But I'm finding that people can access this directly. And as you say, you're not creating it. You're really kind of unlearning the separate sense of self. And when you unlearn that, there it is.
Yes, well, this is why children do better at meditation.
Yes, that's
they
right.
Don't have to be convinced it might be a good idea. That some teachers are now in schools that have the children, not a particular meditation, just put their hand on their head and keep silence for a couple of minutes.
Yeah.
And the kids like to come back to that. The class goes much better if they do that, because it's a way of integrating the deeper dimension of human nature, which is towards the intuitive and unitive experience. Our poor minds are so cluttered and getting more so by a culture that is noisier and faster paced. So this is all the more reason why we need, as a practice, some periods of time in which we can encourage this awareness, this silence, this stillness, as the Bible calls it, or this nothingness, as or shunyata, as the Buddhists call it.
Yes.
It's there. It's waiting to be activated. It's communicating to us all the time, but without words, but
That's
through
right.
symbols of nature and the other people. And yeah. It's that place that more people need to experience if the world is going to find peace, because now we seem to be pushed around by the childish influences of instinctual needs for control and power and security symbols, and all of these are coming out of fear, not out of the affirmation that we're being created in love at every nanosecond of time.
As you mentioned how easy it is for kids, I guess I realized that maybe the way I learned meditation was like many of us, when I was sent into the corner. It used to be punishment, remember? Sent you into the corner to be quiet by yourself. So I think maybe one time when I was sent into the corner in grade school, I started to like it.
Well, that's typical of our time. What is best for you is regarded as the worst thing that can happen.
That's right.
Failure is regarded as a disaster, where it's a place of great learning friendly as some aspect of God that he's revealing to you.
Yeah, and as you say, like the word spirit comes from spiritus, from meaning breath. And the metaphor in Buddhism for emptiness, the metaphor that's used is the invisible life force within a seed that helps it grow into a tree. So there's something invisible and yet dynamic. There's something very, you can't know it with, the reason I think we've missed it is because we've been trying to know it with our minds. We've been trying to find it with effort. We've been trying to will it or you know it with our senses. And this spirit or emptiness that's awake or awake awareness can only know itself. So it's almost by the two main methods are kind of the resting method, which is kind of be quiet and do nothing. And the Zen phrase is muddy water, let stand, becomes clear. And then the inquiry method, which I do a lot, which is to actually unhook awareness from thought and have it open to space, and then be aware of spacious awareness, and then realize that you're aware from spacious awareness, and then that that awareness is embodied and open-hearted and interconnected with everyone and everything. So shifting from head to heart, literally dropping awareness out of its identification with the thinker and letting it know your jaw from within, letting it know your throat, coming into this heart, mind, and then opening to space and including everything, that you start to shift intentionally, using awareness itself to know itself and then return. And so those inquiry and resting, the looking and resting methods seem to be two of the main direct paths. And then prayer and service are the other two, yeah? Now, I hear that the simple version is prayer is talking to God and meditation is listening. What do you think about that?
Yes, listening is so important.
Yeah.
In all the scriptures, it seems to me, and in all the traditions.
Yes.
And it's interesting that in Jesus' life, God the Father recommended that twice, once at his baptism and once on the Mount of Transfiguration, and said to those who were present, this is my beloved Son, listen to him. It didn't say talk to him or anything else.
Yes.
Because listening, what are you doing when you're listening? Nothing, except being totally present.
Present and receptive, right. Yeah, I mean, one interesting thing that might be useful and interesting to people listening is that in our, you know, discovery in science, thinking, if I ask somebody, how do you experience thinking? They tend to describe it almost like a CNN crawl, like words, like they're reading words going across. And so if meditation instruction is watch your thoughts, it almost seems like people try to see them. But really, most of thinking, what's called the the, you know, continuous thinking during the day is inner hearing, inner talk. The thoughts, sometimes they're visual, but the majority of thinking is experienced as inner talk or inner hearing. So in some ways, if you just listen to silence, and then from that silence, listen to thinking and welcome it, you can go right into a sense of presence.
Yes, well, that's what we're trying to do. But put it into context now.
That's right.
It's useful too, and that is that from the evolutionary point of view, the humans are coming out of the Big Bang, and our makeup has been repeated or invented or created for billions of years until we've reached a point in biological evolution where we've come to a new creature who has the capacity to think and reflect and respond, be self-conscious, and yes, to have abstract ideas like compassion and,
yes,
and mercy and so on. But this is called rational consciousness. So,
right. So
the historians even say when that really began in a big way, say maybe from 800 or 200 BC,
yes,
that the rational life expanded greatly, and that's when most of the, or at least many of the great religions and literature were produced sometime in that period. So it was called an axial period by anthropologists recently. And so the question is, are we on the edge of another axial period to move from rational consciousness,
right,
to a higher one? Because we've now discovered that rational consciousness, as you just described it, has limitations.
That's right.
And so thinking is not the whole of reality, but is a useful part of our life on this earth. But that human beings are now in that most difficult stage in the whole evolutionary process, where they're coming from the instinctual domination of our ancestors into a reflective consciousness that leads us ultimately to divine consciousness.
Right.
So we can't bring about divine consciousness, and we can't go back to the irresponsibility of beasts. So we're here with this little window of free will to choose or not to choose, or to consent or to reject this world that God has made, in which we're invited to consent to. And in that consent, then, a basis for maintaining the respect and the constant practice of interior silence, disassociating with our thoughts,
yes,
feelings and sensations, while respecting them, but to build this new dimension of consciousness on that by allowing the dimension which we already have to come to consciousness through deep meditation and prayer. But there are other ways it can come too.
Yes, that's right.
But that seems to be the primary one. So instead of laying a guilt trip on people for being so imperfect, they're supposed to be.
That's right.
Because we're just creatures. We're not God. Only God is perfect.
God, right.
He knows this, and he doesn't expect perfection.
No.
But he,
and the world
he invites us into his own life, which we can't imagine what that is.
That's right.
But that's the invitation. And,
yeah. But we get these.
So, meanwhile, we're stuck in the with our, and we regress to our animal responses. Violence is really a regression instead of an effort to negotiate and collaborate and love each other, and so as to move to this higher stage of consciousness as a society, and not just as it's been mostly in the past, individuals.
That's right. Yes, I agree. I think we may be on the cusp of an axial age, and certainly, at least developmentally, it's possible. So my premise, from having spent most of my time investigating, like you, both contemplative traditions and psychology and science, and kind of really honestly looking with a scientific eye, which just means what's true, what's working, what's real, what's happening. What I've discovered is that what I think is that awakening is the next natural potential stage of human development. So awakening from, as you say, from a rational, thought-based way of knowing to a transrational, which doesn't mean regressive. It doesn't mean putting intellectualism down or intellectual thinking down. It means returning thinking to its natural place as one of the functions of a human being and taking identity out of ego function and letting the ego function. So when we awaken, we don't get rid of our personalities. We don't get rid of our imperfect human nature. We actually discover this post-rational, non-conceptual awareness that is embodied and then open-hearted. And that embodied, interconnected dimension becomes the ground of our being. And that ground of being is literally this far away. It doesn't take a lot of time to develop. What takes time is kind of unlearning or breaking the old habit of selfing, of creating a self over and over. And when we use these methods of inquiry, we can awaken to be more coming from not an ego-centered or self-centered, but from this dimension of our being that naturally has qualities of love and connection, and it wants to do service, and it's not judgmental. Just when you shift into this through small glimpses, at least, it's revealed to be already available to us.
Yes, you can't control it, though.
You can't control it.
And be open to it. But it has a life of its own that's greater than our rational consciousness.
No
handle. And so, but we can reduce the obstacles, as you said.
Yes. Yeah.
And that is what a conversion really is to think of what our motive is for living.
And then you can kind of get on board.
Our faults and turn to the higher power that created us. Certainly we didn't create ourselves.
No.
And you have this balance between recognizing our weakness and at the same time our almost infinite capacity through God's love for us to reach the fullness of the human potential, I guess you'd call it.
Yes.
Which is to become God too, as far as that's possible for a human being.
Yes. Yeah, I think that paradox you mentioned is interesting about intention and non-intention. In some ways, you know, spiritual practice is intentionally at least deconstructing or letting go or putting ourselves in, you know, in the way of grace. But then it requires a surrender. So at some point, any initial intentional practice has to lead to a point of surrendering, it seems. And then the surrender, then we are met, hopefully, at times by grace, by divine presence, or we discover that's always been here. And then the possibility is kind of dancing with that or surfing the silence so that there's kind of an ability then to not go back and create the separate sense of self, but kind of letting God, you know, steer, but we're starting to row a little bit. You know, we're starting to act from this awake consciousness, which we're not controlling, we're not creating, but we're being buoyed up by it. We're being kind of, you know, riding it down the river.
Yes.
Does that sound about
very good? And it's so close, as you said.
Yes.
We think it's far away because we don't sense it or feel it or think it or touch it. But it's closer than our own being is to us, closer than thinking. closer.
That's right.
Than willing, closer than intentionality.
That's right.
And we know from some of the historical accounts of God's relations with various souls down through the ages that he sometimes just shows up without any preparation.
That's right.
Here I am.
That's right.
And I'm just, in other words, what is.
Yes.
We can realize that. We wouldn't have, suffering itself would not be a difficulty because it has a way of teaching us if we accept it, that is a shortcut to wisdom. Because it like nothing else, it makes us realize that we are pretty helpless.
Yes, that's right.
Level of functioning, especially when external circumstances become overwhelming or difficult, or interior trials are too much for us.
That's right. But,
everything comes from love.
Yes.
I had a little idea, maybe I'll just share it for fun. Our editors can remove it if they disapprove. But the sort of four great oceans that we relate to. The ocean of the earth is our rootedness on this planet, where the ocean is the chief amount of material, at least on the surface. So that's the level of the senses and all. And then now they've invented airplanes. So you can go above the earth and get a different view of all that you've experienced when you were just dependent on that level of perception. And so at that level, you coming into an airport, a city at night is just gloriously beautiful until you land and have to move around and you see the slums and the garbage that hasn't been picked up and all the rest of it. But that's not the last ocean. Beyond our atmosphere in which planes can function, there is the space.
Yes.
And that it has no limitation as far as we can see.
Right.
And the space that we know of is constantly enlarging. So where is it going? It's going in just infinitely, or whatever it is, there's no limit. And
yes.
So the sense of spaciousness comes in there.
Yes.
And you can look back at the earth and see how beautiful it is without seeing any of its messiness and so on.
Yeah.
Spectacular sight. And finally, the ultimate ocean, it seems to me, is infinite love. Love that then returns to the stages it's been through and shares that insight on all the other levels and transform them by giving them the ultimate gift that we share, that God has given us. So you have to go through the stages. It's another one of those ladders or stage. And developmental psychology has done a wonderful job in explaining the human development. Yeah. And we're at a stage now where enough rational consciousness manifested in technology has come to makes us think we've come to the end of rational consciousness as the goal.
Yeah.
Developmental ecology says that, why should we stop evolving?
Right.
And the focus now is on especially the evolution of rational consciousness into the intuitive and unitive levels. Such as you encounter in the kind of practices that you suggested a few moments ago.
Yeah. Well, may I dialogue? Let me suggest building on your metaphor by turning it into a glimpse practice. So if people can just begin by feeling that they're the center of the world and they're on the earth, and then just open your awareness, just shift out to the space in the room, and then continue to open, to be interested, and to be aware of space above your house and above as if you were in a plane.
Yes.
And then one more time, surrender any sense of self to the infinite universe. And so now just let go and open until you begin to feel that your awareness has surrendered in any sense of doing or efforting, and you've discovered a universe that's aware of itself by itself.
Yes.
And from that infinite nature, feel as if that awareness is free and transcendent, and then notice just as you're aware of infinite space, that infinite space is within every cell of your body and in every cell of everyone and everything. So there's the awareness is filled with a kind of loving presence. So there's an infinite and a finite, that universe is within you, it's supporting you, and there's a sense of landing home, of being both everywhere, nowhere, and here, and interconnected with everyone from this kind of open-hearted, loving presence, which includes the heart as big as the universe.
Yeah, thank you for enlarging that.
We're playing.
Love is the final word on everything, and it's, but it's not sentimental. It's surrender. And there's one further step, you might say, beyond surrender, and that's to be surrendered.
Okay.
Something that life and other people provide us with.
Yes.
Surrender can still be an ego trip if some...
That's right. Yes, I am surrendered.
Surrendered is to have everything taken away. And this is the great gift of dying. So let's talk about this.
Yes.
Without doing anything but accepting it, everything goes. It's taken away little by little if you have a gradual dying process.
Yes.
So that's why it has to happen to everybody, because it's the peak of human existence and the transition from, without losing any of the values of the lower states of consciousness and sense life, opens to this, as you put it, this boundless awareness that is not us exactly, but is the manifestation in us, in our uniqueness of everything that exists or ever will exist. So in that sense, we're sort of at least psychologically like God, if not ontologically.
Yeah, and as it's recommended,
all this transformation, don't be in the Christian tradition.
Yes,
but the other religions have words for it too that are very helpful.
Yeah.
So we're at a stage where dialogue is replacing missionary activity. So it's not my particular belief system, but what is the basis of everybody's belief system, and where is it going ultimately?
Yes.
It's going into the ocean of love.
Yes. Yes. And this love, this, you know, as it's recommended, you know, dying before you die is this surrender, being surrendered completely, because I think the resistance to this axial age, to this kind of willingness to go and to awaken, is the fear of our separate sense of self, that it will die, but it's not us, so it's not going to die. That surrendering is losing nothing and gaining everything. It's only losing the current sense of being in control, that feels like it's who we are, and it feels like we're going to lose our personhood. But actually, you become, the goal of really spiritual practice is to become fully human, right? As Teilhard de Chardin said, you know, we're not human beings trying to be spiritual. We're spiritual beings learning how to be human.
Yes, it works both ways, that's for sure. Well, this is what's so fascinating about God. He's everything at once.
So yes.
You can say one thing about God without it becoming misleading, unless you say the opposite. And I think that's the reason you find so many contradictions in scripture, because
that's right.
It's talking to different levels of perspective, to those in the ocean of this world or the ocean of space, and the ocean, and try to bring them to the ocean of love, which is total unification. And certainly, this is what Jesus prayed for at the Last Supper, that that all people might be one, even as we are one, which is infinite oneness. I don't think you can do much better than that.
No, you recognize that everything is included. An interesting neuroscience study that they did with a group of Tibetan Buddhist longtime meditators who were doing compassion meditation. And they looked at their brain, and the areas for joy were lighting up, and the areas for peace, and the areas for balance. And then they noticed one little tiny area right in the top of the head. And they said, well, that's interesting. We didn't expect that. What they're doing compassion meditation, but what is this area that's lighting up? And what it was found to be is the area that needs to light up right before you take action to do anything. So compassion naturally leads to the impetus to act from compassion and do service and actions of love and compassionate activity. That when you feel this ocean of love, there's a natural gratitude and feeling of generosity of spirit. And from that flows kindness and charity and different ways to, you know, help your neighbor.
Beautiful. Well, just to add one little line to that example I gave of the various oceans.
Yes.
There's a very profound experience in the mystical life, and I'm pretty sure it's represented in just about every religion, in which one is surrendering to God, but God is working on that to bring it to a further level of being surrendered, so that everything is just as it should be. One of the Buddhist teachers used to say, everything just as it is right now is perfect.
Yeah.
Well, from what point of view, please?
Right.
Not from certain levels, but
no.
But ultimately, this is God's view. And
yeah.
So the movement into freedom, which is what God seems to be one of his chief characteristics, is in being free of all the attachment to previous levels of consciousness.
Yes.
Without despising them or leaving them behind, but of bringing them to what they really tended to be, stepping stones to the presence of God or manifestations of some aspect.
Yes.
So, but as a point sometimes in the spiritual journey where all the things we depended upon in our spiritual practices don't work anymore.
Right.
Where the sense of being helpless or mm-hmm. spiritually destitute,
yes,
however other people look at you, you sort of know that and feel profoundly this desperation. And it's like being shoved into an abyss of darkness, where there's absolutely nothing to hold on to, and you start falling, and you think, well, this is really the end of me completely. I'm going to hit the ground or the ocean. I'll become just a drop in the ocean. That I have no more identity. And so you accept that. That's what this being surrendered means. Anything. And to its acceptance of being nothing, of being a creature radically. Then when you hit the ground and gradually wake up, you find that you're not just a drop in the ocean, but that the ocean has now moved into you.
That's right.
And that means that you've really died to the ego and the false.
That's right.
And are now fully what you would like to be.
Yes. And, you know, I think...
God wants you to be.
Yes, and I think you can report this as well, but I mean, in terms of this new age or axial age of awakening, that many people are describing what you're describing. Some people may think, you know, being surrendered or discovering this ocean of love is some esoteric, achievement for Olympic athletes of meditation. But I'm finding that people living in the midst of New York City who have an open heart and a willingness to do some of these spiritual practices and stay with them on a daily basis, go through this period of surrender and letting go. And they may go through a kind of a detox or a dark night or a letting go, but then they discover that this ocean of love is a new view. It's a new feeling of who they really are, and that the other levels of ups and downs of life, which continue, things go well, things don't go well, they have losses, grief, you know, they're felt in a different context. There's a new view and a new you, which can bear what seemed to be unbearable.
Yes, that describes it well, I think.
Yeah.
It's true. And I think you find in many terrible situations, slums and ghettos and so on, or the people Mother Teresa used to pick off all the streets,
yes,
of Calcutta and elsewhere now, that what is so pathetic is that these people don't realize they're the most precious concerns of the Creator.
And yes,
he fuses them sometimes through that, the very difficulties of their external life.
That's
right. But the same wisdom that we pursue in more concrete terms, in a reasonably ordinary life. There's a little story in one of Jean Vanier's books, which he went into a slum. I think Mother Teresa might have been with him. But anyway, he went into this household where the mother and the children were obviously undernourished and on the verge of starvation. And after a little talk, he said he had a little money in his pocket and he gave it to her. She immediately went next door and gave half of it to their neighbors. And he was just overwhelmed by this. But when he came back, he couldn't resist asking her, well, how could you do that? Your children are on the verge of starvation. And she said, well, they're starving too.
Yes.
Without any learning or discipline, she had received through circumstances an intuition that is incredibly precious, that everyone is equal and that everybody's sufferings are ours and vice versa. And everything is held in common.
Yes.
But to realize that deeply would change the world. And I guess it's not quite time for that to happen on a massive scale. But if it happened even on a little scale,
yes,
it could introduce the human family to this new level that possibly is forming, in which everyone is equal, everyone is everyone else, and everyone is in God, and God is in everyone, but uniquely in everyone, so everyone can bring their particular gift. And I think they've always, at least I was always taught, that God is present in each person uniquely.
Yes.
And has a personal relationship with them that nobody else can ever have. It's unique to that person.
Yes. There's something in common on the spiritual level that we're all the same, and yet we express
infinitely diverse at the same time.
Infinitely diverse.
God is infinite unity, infinite diversity. So if we're going to become like God, like we better expand our consciousness a bit and not regard everybody as our neighbor, as an opponent or a competitor or something. They're to be loved and forgiven if that's necessary.
Yes. So this is beautiful. We're kind of wrapping up here, and it looks like we're kind of back, circling back to where we began, that within each of us is this unique capacity that we're already connected, have always already been connected to the divine and to this kind of presence, whatever you want to call that, this dimension of consciousness, which even if, whether you're religious or not religious, there's some clear unitive consciousness that's available with these spiritual practices. And then when you discover this, it leads to a natural compassion and activity, which we all need in this world today. So it's not about escaping reality, but it's actually learning how to be fully human by discovering the most subtle, higher dimensions of consciousness, which are deeper, wider, and interconnected to all of us.
Yes.
So it's been a wonderful pleasure to be with you, Father Thomas.
Thanks.
As always.
This time, I enjoyed it.
Okay.
I don't usually have such distinguished visitors in my room.
It's great to be with you. And we thank everyone else for joining us and hope you all enjoyed our discussion. And we'll see you all sometime soon.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest right now? Are you feeling lonely, unappreciated, or misunderstood? When you keep these feelings bottled up, they can affect you negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's a great way to increase your self-awareness, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.